It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about franchising and governance again after a fine is levied, the demise of Level 7 apprenticeships, and discussing how we frame the needs of students in the future. It's all coming up.
We need to be really careful with that analogy. And yes, absolutely, we need to do everything we can to maintain quality and the wider student experience and support. You know, whenever you poll students on them being viewed as customers or consumers, it never goes down particularly well.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Peach. Joining me to unpick the week in HE policy, we have three fantastic guests as always. And in Whitechapel, it's Alex Stanley, Vice President for Higher Education of the National Union of Students. Alex, your highlight of the week, please.
Thank you very much and good morning. My highlight of the week is that I'm finally taking some annual leave and going on holiday with some of my friends from university.
Lovely. And on campus, it's Pam McPherson-Barrett, Head of Policy and Regulation at the University of Leeds. Pam, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning, Mark. My highlight of the week actually happened at the end of last week. I had a meeting with the Lightness Policy Network. It was really great to catch up with colleagues from across the sector and talk all things policy. Plus, there was a very excellent tiramisu the night before.
Very nice. And somewhere in the West Country, no one quite knows where, it's David Kernahan, DK to you and me. Dear Wonky's Deputy Editor, DK, your highlight of the week, please.
That would have to be a week of annual leave I spent in Sierra Nevada. It was blisteringly hot and it was utterly beautiful.
Very good. Okay, so we start the week with franchising and governance back in the news. DK, walk us through it, please.
So way back in February 2024, the Office of Students opened an investigation into Leeds Trinity University, specifically the partnership arrangements that it had entered into. This came to a conclusion last week while I was away, and the two parties, the OFS and Leeds Trinity, have reached a settlement of £115,000 of a fine. Leeds Trinity University is also going to be subject to additional regulatory requirements, including a restriction on recruitment to its subcontracted courses. This is interesting because both the government and OFS have been making a lot of noise about franchise and partnership arrangements, and the regulator has particularly been focusing on the oversight arrangements at lead providers, making sure everything is of the required quality and rigor. Obviously, in this case, there was a problem. It looks from reading the very short report to have been a capacity problem, but this appears to be the way in which OFS is going to deal with concerns about franchise provisions going forward.
Right. So we've been covering this, haven't we, a lot on The Wonky Show and on Wonky in general, this long-running saga of franchising, and clearly lots more to come. Pam, this is an interesting new turn, though, isn't it? Because this, I guess, is the first time we're seeing the regulator, you know, come to some kind of conclusion of its action. But, you know, we're going beyond kind of press release, and now we're going to go into action. Do you think this kind of moves the dial in where we are as a sector?
I think it really is interesting, isn't it? And for me, you know, the fact that the focus was very much on that leadership and governance piece, and it was E6, I think, that was breached. No, it wasn't. It was E2. But that chimes very much with what the OFS has been saying over the past year around governance structures and making sure that in challenging times, providers have sufficient oversight of their activities. I think the other thing that, I mean, I don't know, I'm not at Leeds Trinity. I haven't talked to anybody there, but the press release from the Office for Students is felt much better and much more collaborative than some of the other long-running sagas that we've seen published previously. So I think you're right, Mark. There is definitely a move from that combative press release to something that might be more beneficial to the sector as we think about how we manage our various relationships.
Mm. Alex, do you welcome this kind of focus on governance as kind of the root cause of this, or is the regulator kind of starting from the right starting place when it comes to dealing with this issue?
I mean, look, I think it's another large fine from the OFS, isn't it? At a time where they've equally said, as well as governance, that they're going to be having a laser focus on the financial sustainability of the sector. And I mean, just a couple of months ago, we saw a fine of £585,000 to an institution letting go of 300 members of staff in a voluntary severance scheme. And now we've got this. Like, I can understand why there may be some frustration from parts of the sector. But of course, good governance and high quality regulatory conditions are absolutely crucial, particularly if we're going to see the expansion of franchise provision. But I think if we have seen any negligence or any sort of behavior that has damaged quality or governance, the bottom line is that it's going to be students who are feeling the brunt of this. And that seems to be the case time and time again. And I do get that the circumstances that we find ourselves in are very challenging as a sector, and that franchise agreements can be lucrative and that there is definitely appetite for them in the sector. And equally that franchise agreements can be important because we want to see higher education provision as far and as wide as possible. But I think this is another example of universities being backed into a corner because they're desperate for more funding at a time where the market's becoming more challenging and potentially more volatile. And I really hope that this isn't another situation where students are the ones bearing the brunt of that. And if the OFS's intervention here takes us in the right direction, then I welcome it.
Mm. There's every sign, isn't there, that the governor in Westminster at least is going to be focusing more on governance and holding governing bodies more accountable for the decisions that happen underneath them. That kind of ups the ante again, doesn't it, DK, in terms of kind of this question of governance, which has long been discussed in the sector. Do we have the right model? Is it working? And is it ready for greater governance scrutiny?
So interesting. If you look right back to earlier this year when Jackie Smith was interviewed by the chief of the ECU, Joe Grady, one of Joe Grady's asks from union members was a review of university governance. Now, it's always difficult to read into what ECU are actually asking for. I think they may have meant leadership rather than the specifics of governance. But there has been an ongoing emphasis on the quality of decisions that are being made by universities. And that does point the finger towards, as we've seen in this Leeds Trinity example, and as we see in other issues around the wider sector, we think of the University of Dundee in particular, the quality and oversight of decisions that are being made by senior people. Now, governance, that's the oversight piece. It's not for university governors to decide to lay off staff or to close courses. It's for the executive. It is for the governors to hold that executive to account. And there are a number of questions as to how close the governors, the members of your university board, or whatever you call it, your place, and the executive actually are. There can be a lack of diversity in governance, which means you get this kind of quite rigid, quite scared business thinking sometimes. And there are also questions about the power that governors actually have in order to properly hold very senior staff, such as vice chancellors, such as directors of finance, properly to account, or if that's just like a little omerta that you don't talk about, that you don't do that. It's long overdue another look. As you say, we've been talking about this for years and years and years. With the scale of universities and with the kind of decisions that are being made at universities in this time of financial peril having an impact on more and more people, I mean, this is long overdue.
Yeah. I mean, Alex, how would you reform governance if you were, you're putting you on the spot? What's if there was a big review of university governance? What are the kind of key things you'd like to see changed?
Well, look, I don't have a magic wand that I'd like to wave, but I'd
echo. Assume you had the wand. Assume you had the magic.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? Well, I think I'd echo a lot of what I that has been said previously about accountability and about there being genuine scrutiny of university executives. And I mean, recently we've seen a lot of hit pieces, haven't we, on vice chancellors with regard to pay and expenses. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that you see these high salaries and you see failures like the ones at Dundee and difficult circumstances across the sector where executive bodies are bored to having to make, more and more challenging decisions, letting staff go. And I think we need to make sure that, one, those are the right decisions, but two, they're being made with the interests of staff and the interests of students. And I think that when you're the ones, in the room all the time making those operations, operational and strategic decisions, there is a lot of pressure on you to make those decisions the right way. And I think having that oversight, but also genuine accountability from above and from your board is absolutely crucial. And if that isn't happening in places, then it needs to soon, because it's more important than ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, there's something about an effective governing body being able to draw the threads together. So, you know, this is one of the few places in a university or any provider where they will start seeing the different threads. So, for example, in the Leeds Trinity case, it says that the team that was in charge of monitoring and assessing quality at their partners were overwhelmed by the number of partnerships. Now, the governing body is an opportunity to look at where those risks are in different areas of a university and think about, well, you know, is decision making happening effectively? Is it a two-way process? When we're devolving, are we devolving in the right way? I think those are the sorts of things that we've really got to think about how we support our governors with. It's like, yeah, I agree, DK, we need more diversity in governing bodies. We need more challenge. But that means that you're not getting a governing body where everybody has a complete suite of skills. So we've got to think really carefully about how you might, you know, enable somebody who has got that, you know, risk and audit experience to support somebody who has got deep experience engaging with local communities, for example.
But you can only sort of do what you can with the information you're given as a governor, can't you? Because, you know, I mean, take an example like the franchising, which is, you know, being raised in a lot of different providers. You could have, you know, the world's greatest expert about risk and whatever, but it may never even come to the attention of the board in the first place that there are all these partnerships and who they're with and whatever. I mean, you expect them to ask questions about those sorts of things. You expect them to know that there's kind of regulatory impact, but actually, you know, there might be much bigger kind of fish to fry from a kind of governance point of view. If the university's got significant financial problems, you've got, you know, a big change agenda or whatever. It's a sort of thing that I can kind of imagine going under the radar unless someone kind of really makes it their own thing. But I mean, presumably the noise about this across the sector now means that governors who may not have been paying a lot of attention to kind of partnerships and franchise arrangements will probably be asking that question at least. Because, yeah, as I say, you don't know, unless it's been put in front of you, you're sort of, as a governor, you just don't know what you don't know, particularly if you don't work in a sector and kind of know all different sort of permutations of what might be happening and the sorts of activity, all the kind of codes that we use to describe, you know, academic partnerships or something like that, you know, might sound very, very benign, but, you know, could be a little, you know, bomb waiting to explode.
I think Pam raised an interesting point about the team that are responsible for franchise partnerships saying that they were overwhelmed. Now, if a team like that is mission critical is saying that it is overwhelmed and that is either not being heard or not being listened to at a senior level, then, I mean, that in itself is a governance problem, in that part of the job of the board is that the government need to make sure all the different parts of the university are speaking to each other. So if you're seeing, I imagine it's an office in the academic registry. I imagine that they're probably understaffed. They've been subject to cuts recently and being looked to doing massive expansion. This is absolutely mission critical stuff. So for me, the big unanswered question in the regulatory report is, why were these staff not listened to, and what steps can be taken in order to make sure that in future people raising that kind of concern, I mean, be that in Leeds Trinity or elsewhere, are being listened to. I didn't see anything in the OFS response about that. They seemed happy to do the fine and the restriction on recruitment, which obviously will solve the problem in a certain way, but it doesn't feel like a universal decision to say, okay, we need to ensure that in all universities, people are listening to the members of staff. Often, I mean, quite low paid members of staff, that's quite a junior role in registry, is to look after that stuff. And they need to be properly listened to.
CDBU have put out a code of ethical university governance, or also some suggestions of parameters of one. Do you think that's the right approach, Pam?
I think it's one approach, Mark. And it's like motherhood and apple pie. Who wouldn't say that ethical governance is a good thing? where the challenge is, you know, as the consultation that they're putting out says, there is the CUC code of governance that's codified within the Office of Students' conditions of registration. So how do you knit all these different elements together to support your governing body to work effectively? And as you mentioned earlier, how do you help them find out what they don't know?
I think the other thing for me would be, we still need to be able to balance that real serious responsibility. Some of those conditions of registration, or things like the FIRS, Foreign Influence Registration Scheme, some of the kind of non-compliance can come with not only significant fines but potentially jail terms for those who are not in compliance. So I'm a little bit concerned that we're just trying to throw lots of things at a governing body without just taking a step back and thinking holistically about what is it that we need higher education governance to do effectively, and how do we start building that almost from the ground up.
Yeah. All right. And on that bombshell, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Zoe Ullman, and together with Chris Wright, this week on Wonky, we've been blogging about the impact of developing students' drawing and creative skills on mental health and the sense of belonging. At De Montfort University, we were increasingly aware of a need to better support students to develop confidence in drawing and mark making, skills that underpin a wide range of academic disciplines. In response, Chris established De Montfort's Drawing Centre, and it's grown to become a core part of university activity, engaging over 2,600 student visits each year. Through non-assessed creative play, exploration and activity, students are challenged to explore stimuli and tasks in different ways. Doing this, students share their experiences, often exploring and expressing deeper concepts than purely the physical medium in which they're working in or in response to the task set. 96% of Drawing Centre users recognise this as an important learning community, acknowledging creative skill development and, beyond that, resilience. The non-assessed approach is considered non-judgmental. The learning environment supports students to develop a toolbox of skills for use in any task, preparing them for lifelong learning, ultimately supporting mental health and a sense of belonging.
So, final confirmation this week about government decision on level 7 apprenticeships. Pam, walk us through that, please.
So, this is, again, something that we've been waiting for a little while. There's been rumours about whether or not apprenticeships will continue to be funded at level 7. There's been a lot of campaigning because a number of professional organisations, not least of which is the NHS, have some quite critical pieces of professional development that they have been funding through level 7 apprenticeships. Nonetheless, the government has decided to remove funding, apart from some odd little edge cases of 16 to 21-year-olds and those care experienced, in order to release that funding for additional lower level apprentices. So I think there's been lots of pleasure, and quite rightly so, that lower level apprentices will receive more funding, and that level of provision should go. But equally, lots of concern about where that pipeline's going to go and how you support the development of highly skilled professionals outside a sort of classical master's route.
Right. So there's been mixed reaction to this, as Pam said. Alex, what do you think? Because I think clearly that's going to have some unintended consequences. Some good things are going to be lost. But if you had to weigh up the kind of decisions the government has to make about what to fund, this also kind of chimes with what they're trying to achieve more broadly, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think Pam summarised it really well, to be honest. It is a real mixed bag. I mean, we get that there are difficult political and financial decisions for the government to make whilst they're pushing for their missions. But I mean, this is disappointing in some senses. I mean, the reality is that for the government to genuinely achieve their ambition of breaking down barriers to opportunity, they will need to actively invest in the sector and in apprenticeships at a number of levels, not just level 7, of course. And for the levy funding to be rebalanced rather than for there to be explicit investment, I don't think that quite does that. And obviously, it's good to see those exemptions. We think apprenticeships are fantastic for school leavers and for young workers, those joining the labour market. But they're also really important for reskilling and upskilling workers. And on a more practical level, there just aren't many under 21s on level 7 apprenticeships anyways. I think it's under 10%. And I think that's why you've seen so much frustration from universities who've been heavily investing in those apprenticeships. not just because of the sort of the cash that will be strapped from them, but also because they're willing to feed into the government's missions of sort of regional growth and the civic role that universities can be playing there. So I hope that we're not starting to miss out there, because I think level 7 apprenticeships have been a really solid and consistent means for sort of achieving that and working with local employers to expand the range of high level skills in the economy, as Skills England itself really wants to set out in its forecast. So as I said at the start, a mixed bag, but I can see why the government have done it.
University business schools in particular, a few of them are exposed to this kind of the stuff that Chartered Management Institute does, the stuff that we get for senior leaderships, senior HR people, and I mean, universities may have an involvement there. The big one that is going to be okay, though, in terms of that it tends to have a lot of under 22s kicking off, is the tax and accountancy professional apprenticeships, and those are also looked after by university business schools quite often. Now, I agree, I think, with Alex that this is an interesting move for a government that is looking to expand access to the professions. A lot of this stuff, the apprenticeships at level 7 are an alternative to, I mean, doing a degree and then doing a master's to get into a profession such as, say, architecture or law. And it does feel like if you're making it harder for these apprenticeships to be offered, I think we should be clear that this does make it harder. It does not stop companies from offering apprenticeships themselves if they want to pay for them directly, as opposed to out of the levy, which is also their money, but they have to get back from the government. Such like. I think with this announcement, I was also expecting there to be something about the amount of the levy that is not spent and is effectively clawed back by the Treasury as an additional tax. I think there'd be a good case to say if we're serious about expanding lower level apprenticeships for young people, then maybe those unspent funds should be hypothecated or should be used in the public sector to offer apprenticeships in, as you say, the NHS or in local councils or elsewhere. So yeah, it's a bit of a mixed decision. It's going to have different impacts in different places. There's not an overall really, this is bad for these people and good for these people story to be told, but it does make us ask questions about the commitment of the government to providing access to the professions for people outside of the academic traditional route.
The only other thing I wanted to note is that there's a very interesting turn of phrase on the kind of final paragraph of the Bridget Phillotson quote, where she says, "Everyone has a role to play in a thriving economy, and we're taking our responsibility seriously, providing more routes into employment. It's now the responsibility of young people to take them." And I wonder whether or not this is just, you know, this the start of a set of conversations that the government is going to be having around it's not just about you go and get the job that you want or you study the subject that you want, but actually the government wants to move people into those shortage occupations, those shortage areas. That it might be a little bit more direct. If I wonder if when we see that higher education or, you know, post 18 white paper, that there might be a little bit more to come in that vein.
Right, incoming Offers for Students Chair Edward Peck has written an interesting piece about future trends for campus universities and students. Alex, talk us through that, please.
Absolutely. So the paper is in the Higher Education Policy Institute and is focusing on the future of the campus university. And it highlights 10 key trends that he believes will help shape the future of higher education, and particularly the English sector. It's been pitched as a set of lessons learned from his work as the DfE's Higher Education Student Support Champion, in which will be his final report in the role. Some of these lessons include the impact of tuition fees, where Peck says that with hindsight, perhaps 2012 constituted the moment that the sector had the opportunity to embrace a customer service ethos wholeheartedly, which I'm sure will make for an interesting discussion after this. A lot on the role of technology too, and also students' increased expectations about support. So all in all, the report makes for a very interesting read and really points to just how fast-paced change in the sector has been and will likely continue to be. be?
So this is quite a short paper. It is well written. If you've been following discussions around the sector, there's not really anything in here that's going to come as a massive surprise to you. He does identify the trends that you'd think. For me, the interesting paragraph looking at his next role is on the impact of regulation. He does describe independent regulation as a relatively new arrival in English higher education, something which a number of older observers might perhaps raise an eyebrow of, because we've had independent regulation for quite a long time. It's just not been as noisy, I guess, about his supposed independent. So he notes the fact that, I mean, a higher education regulator is a focal point for every concern about higher education that's raised by all of the stakeholders, by politicians, public, parents, by the press, by students, and by providers themselves. And it just means that he is thinking that a small number of issues might require regulatory action, but quite a lot. It is going to be a lot of explaining, a lot of actually going into the depths of what is actually going on in universities and reflecting that back to the other stakeholders. That to me looks like that's potentially good news for the sector itself, for the producers, but you have to ask the question, where is the threshold? What is the point at which students, for example, as an obvious and key stakeholder, would say, okay, we're paying a lot of money in fees and we're not getting the things that we expected when we signed up. What's the regulator going to do about it? The regulator has been set up in a way in which is quite good at acting in individual cases. We talked about earlier with the Trinity University stuff, and we've seen with the University of Sussex stuff on freedom of speech. But it's not as good as with seeing with the financial crisis as dealing with problems the entire sector is facing as a whole because of a systemic issue. What I would like to have seen on this paper that perhaps Edward Pett will set out in the weeks and months to come is the way he deals with the overall sector as opposed to individual institutional problems.
I think where the OFS has done regulation well, it has been on a more constrained piece of activity. So the kind of, you know, the sexual harassment and misconduct, I think, is a really good example of where the sector wasn't getting to where it needed to be. And there were, you know, severe impacts on a range of students. And hopefully by the imposition of this new condition as a whole, we will move to a much better place. I think for students, though, there is, you know, we've just gone through a series of student focus groups at the University of Leeds, which we do to hear about their concerns in relation to access and participation, for example. Students often don't know about the Office for Students. When they hear that there is such an organisation, they're pleased that it's there and they hope that it is looking out for their interests. But I guess I'm less clear that that's exactly how the OFS operates. And there is something about how empowered students are to advocate for themselves as well. So I mean, the point about the educational plans that's made within this, you know, my 13-year-old has had one of those his entire school career. I'm not sure that he would particularly welcome that level of intervention if he does go to university, because you know, that can be quite a claustrophobic and a constraining way of experiencing education. For me, I think we just need to think a little bit more holistically. I mean, student as consumer is not the wording that I would choose, but that, you know, that student focus. These are our, you know, education is the main product of university. We've got to think about what that means in the 21st century with the impact of the changing technological capabilities that are, you know, increasing exponentially over the next few years. We really do need to think as a sector about what value our product has and how do we make sure that we evolve it so it retains value over time.
First of all, on that point around awareness of the OFS, I think it's about 30% of students who know about the Office for Students in some way, shape or form. And I imagine that a significant chunk of those probably think that its purpose is actually that of the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. So there's definitely a lot of work that Edward Peck has on his plate there in terms of that awareness piece. But I did find a lot of the content on students as consumers very interesting. And I'll touch on the sort of idea of a student as a consumer in a second. But I mean, Peck talks about the sort of long-standing debate about whether higher education represents good value. And I think the reality is that the more tuition fees go up, the louder this conversation will continue to get, and the greater the expectations of providers will be, and potentially the greater the pressure from the regulator will be. And I can promise you that students aren't having the same conversations that vice chancellors are about how the value of the fee has been drastically declining over the last decade, or that the national insurance rise has swallowed the recent fee increase. They're seeing themselves paying more and more. They're comparing their experience to that of their parents, who most likely got free education. And that is setting the bar for institutions higher and higher. And that's whether we're talking about the academic side of things or support, like Peck also touches on as well. But on students being consumers, I don't think they ever will be in the same way that we sort of ordinarily talk about consumers. I mean, if you take somebody going to a restaurant, for instance, and buying a burger, if they don't like that burger, they can go and take their custom elsewhere. But that ability to withdraw yourself, or to almost have accountability as a consumer, just doesn't exist for students in the same way, because quite often you're entrenched in the community. You know, your X amount of time through a degree, you've got credits accumulated that you may not be able to transfer elsewhere. You've signed up to a housing contract that you may not be able to leave. You know, you've got friends in the area. So I don't think students quite have consumer rights in the same way. And so I think we need to be really careful with that analogy. And yes, absolutely, we need to do everything we can to maintain quality and the wider student experience and support, and, you know, update technology and utilize it, as Peck mentioned. But I think that lens, one, isn't particularly useful, as I don't think it's entirely accurate. But also, you know, whenever you poll students on them being viewed as customers or consumers, it never goes down particularly well.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Alex, Pam, DK and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.